The 1980s has been the warmest decade on record, and it's gotten scientists and laypeople wondering if this is a result of the greenhouse effect. The greenhouse effect is a way of describing why the Earth's climate seems to be getting warmer. Ever since the Industrial Revolution, increased amounts of carbon dioxide, methane, and chlorofluorocarbons have been released into the atmosphere. And the theory is that their abundance is trapping heat and creating a warming trend. It's like in a greenhouse, where the glass allows the warmth of the sun to come through, but prevents the warm air from getting out. My guest, Stephen Schneider, is a climatologist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research and the author of a new book called Global Warming. Let's get back to the 80s, the warmest decade on record. Is it coincidence or is it the greenhouse effect? I posed the question to Stephen Schneider.
Yes, I think we probably have pretty good signs that the pollution we've already put in the past century is showing up in the record as the 1980s is the warmest decade on record. But I can't say that for sure. The problem is a decade of intense warm does not prove that the greenhouse effect, the way it's been modified by our pollution, is here. It's very suggestive, but it doesn't absolutely prove it. The difficulty is when you listen to some scientist who says, we haven't proved it, we have to wait 10 or 20 years, that's not a free deal. Because if we wait 10 or 20 years to be certain, it's at the price of forcing the planet to have to adapt to a much larger dose of change than if we acted now. And whether, of course, to respond to that isn't a scientific question, but a value question.
Let's look at some of the proposals for how to deal with the greenhouse effect. One proposal is, well, if the temperature's rising, let's try to alter the climate to bring the temperature down. Can that be done, and what effect would that have?
It probably can be done. For example, if you use the airplanes we fly around now and you put certain chemicals in the fuel so that it would spew dust up in the stratosphere, I suppose, or you deliberately spread soot up there, I suppose you might actually be able to influence the climate. But think about this. The most probable increase for the future temperature is about 5 degrees Fahrenheit in the middle of the next century. Supposing that's wrong, and we could easily be wrong by, say, a factor of 2, supposing it only ended up 2.5 degrees, and you spread enough dust up there to try to counteract 5 degrees, but it turned out it only would have warmed 2.5, and you also made a mistake in calculating the deliberate intervention, and instead of cooling down 5, you cooled down 10. That would be an ice age. The point is the cure is likely to be worse than the disease. As long as we are as ignorant as we are about the details of how the climate works, and the only thing we really know for sure is magnitudes and rates of change, then it's very dangerous to start monkeying around. Even worse, 88 was an awfully difficult year. Nobody responsible has argued that the greenhouse effect made that one year as bad as it was. We think that that kind of event will happen with much more likelihood in the future as the planet warms up, but no one year is caused by a global trend. So think what would happen if some countries got together, started monkeying around with the climate, and then by chance an 88 occurred and Bangladesh was flooded. Imagine the potential for conflict under those circumstances. A number of years ago, I sort of jokingly said with a colleague of mine that if we're going to try to modify the climate on purpose, we better have no-fault climate disaster insurance, because you're never going to be able to prove whether or not you caused those bad random weather anomalies that happened by chance in the year of your experiment.
Well, what do you think of the posture of adaptation? Will adapt to the changes?
Well, adaptation, I think, is a good idea as long as you don't use it as an excuse to avoid prevention. Adaptation is sort of the favorite line of economists who say, well, we don't like laws and we don't like taxes and rules, so let's let the market system operate. And they have one, I think, strong argument, which is that if we spend all of our resources now hedging against potential problems in the future, we won't use any resources to make the future wealthier, and if it's wealthier, it has a better chance to adapt. So the question isn't whether you should or shouldn't adapt. I think it would be foolhardy not to adapt. And to adapt, you have to do things like have strong research programs in the agricultural universities to develop crops that can deal with warmer or warmer climates or enhanced variability. Invest in efficient irrigation systems, for example, so that, especially in the West, where water shortages are already a problem and heat could drive that worse, so that you'd have the capacity to be less harmed. And it turns out that those kinds of adaptation strategies actually make sense even if the climate doesn't change, because you're still going to get hot years just from nature or dry years, and it'll help you to get through those. So some degree of adaptation makes sense. But if you use adaptation as an excuse to avoid prevention, then I think it has the potential to be a dangerous policy. So I'm very strongly in favor of adaptation strategies. I believe it's not enough, at least not in my value system.
Would you recommend any policy changes by the United States, changes that would help curtail the greenhouse effect?
I think there are several things that the U.S. needs to do. First, we have to set a world example that we can use energy more efficiently. It's easy for us. We waste at least half our energy. It leaks out of bad windows and inefficient cars and bad industrial machines. We're actually going to save ourselves money by doing that. We make an investment, but over the 20-year lifetime of those products, it actually saves us money. That will take some policies. There are already several bills in front of Congress. Senator Tim Wirth from Colorado, Al Gore from Tennessee, Representative Claudine Schneider from Rhode Island, and these are both sides of the aisle, have submitted bills that can do that. We have to work with countries that are deforesting to help them reforest and to give them alternatives. I think that will take some foreign aid as well as some jawboning with those countries. We have to try to provide more advanced technologies to China and India, for example, so they can have more efficient technologies. We need to see to it that our water supply systems are more efficient so that we can adapt more easily to changes in the future. And we have to be careful about coastal protection because rising sea level and the potential for increased hurricanes is very serious. And we'll have to re-examine coastal land use and see what we can do about protecting wetlands. All of those things can be done legislatively. And ultimately, we have to say the more people there are on the planet, either the lower the standard of living will be or the higher the pollution. And we have got to get off, in my view, this nonsense that somehow it's interfering with people's lives to give them birth control information. Any country that wants information about family planning and wants help certainly should be given that help. That'll help reduce pollution and give them a chance to develop in less polluting ways.
It seems to me that the more scared we are about planetary disaster, the more action we're apt to take to try to stop it. And that could lead scientists such as yourself to try to be prophets of doom, you know, in the hopes of like scaring us all into being more responsible in our behavior. Is that something that you think some scientists fall prey to? And is that something you feel you have to hold yourself back from?
Yeah, Terry, you're right. Scientists is in what I like to call a double ethical bind. You know, on the one hand, although we don't have a Hippocratic oath like the doctors, we're sworn to tell the truth. Now, the truth doesn't mean that we know the answer. The truth means the state of the art, and the state of the art has lots of uncertainties. So that means all the caveats, all the things we don't know, and I hope I've gotten some of those across today as well. On the other hand, we're human beings. We're citizens of the planet. We want it to be a better place. Well, that means we want to advance our worldview. Mine is to reduce the risk of rapid climate change and to make development environmentally sustainable. So that has two obligations. The first one is to admit what your worldview is, and the second one is to work like mad to achieve it. Well, that means use the media. You don't get into the media easily with lots of ifs, ands, and buts and two-minute statements. Bumper sticker-length scary things are much better. So the double ethical bind, then, is finding that balance between being effective and telling the whole truth. The most important thing that people have to recognize is that making policy is not based, as scientists like, on some 99% certainty. None of us expect the insurance company to lose when we buy health insurance, but we can't afford the risk of catastrophic loss. Even though on average they make money on our health insurance, we still pay out the premium. My view is we can't afford to have catastrophically rapid climate change, and we've got to pay the premium of being a more efficient society of cutting deforestation and so forth, and it gives us multiple benefits as well. So in that system, I think I'm quite comfortable in selling the fact that I don't want to take the risk of the high-end problems, you know, the rapid ones. But I always do try, personally at least, to say it doesn't have to be that way, and it isn't because I'm sure that things are going to be terrible that makes me advocate policy, but simply because it's better than an even bet, and that in my rationality, you don't want to take that chance, just as most of us buy health insurance.
What's the most encouraging thing you've seen in the past few years? In terms of individuals or governments taking action in the light of their knowledge of the greenhouse effect?
Yeah. Two things that are encouraging. One is that the greenhouse effect is no longer an obscure scientific idea. It's a household word. I can measure that by sitting on an airplane, and if I'm reading the stuff I usually read and people start asking me questions, in fact, they can't get my work done anymore. They're always asking me questions about it. Whereas even early in 88, you're most likely to be ignored as sort of a boring guy reading some junk on an airplane before that. So I think people are aware. And the second thing may not sound like it has anything to do with climate or the environment, but it is the current increasing reduction in tension among East and West, you know, the Gorbachev era, and I never thought I would be that praiseworthy of Ronald Reagan's foreign policy, but I give him a lot of credit for not getting in the way of it, but for going along with it, because there's really no hope of coming up with the tens of billions of dollars a year that we're going to need to make globally environmentally sustainable development the priority for the next century if we're spending $1 trillion on arms. So I'm not entirely pessimistic. I'm quite optimistic that the opportunity to find the capital to solve the problem is there. We've got to keep that disengagement going, and we have to find ways to convert that money to practical uses.